Wisconsin has certainly had its share of severe weather this past year, hasn't it? June just seemed like there was constantly a threat of severe storms or tornadoes or whatever. It was miserable in many ways, but was it a record-breaking month for that kind of weather? Might be hard to know, except that we have the weather guys with us today to talk about it. They always have a way of explaining complex topics in a way that not only you and I can understand, but they do it because they like to share it with others. Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW, as also a professor of atmospheric sciences. And great to have you with us, Steve.
It's great to be here today.
And John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Good to have you back, John.
Always a pleasure, Larry.
It always works better when I turn your microphone on.
You might have to say it again.
Always a pleasure.
And he shuts you off.
I promise not to turn you off anymore. You may have a weather question as you listen into these characters. I hope you do. And give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. There's been a lot of severe weather lately. Earlier this month, Nebraska was hit by a double tornado. We've got a video, I believe, up on that, or at least a photo up on that on my Facebook page. Just last night, we had storms.
It looks like we had another tornado.
Wisconsin. This double tornado was interesting. I don't know if you guys saw the photo. You probably have anyway.
Yeah, one
from Nebraska. That was really unbelievable.
Yeah, it's up on my Facebook. How does that happen?
Well, anytime there's a tornadic storm, there was another really good video that illustrates this point from maybe a similar outbreak in June. There's always a variety of little smaller vortices called suction vortices that are involved in the tornadic environment. And I guess occasionally you can get the conglomeration of a half a dozen or so of those in separate fairly large-scale funnels that you see. And I think that's probably what happened in the Nebraska tornado. But that's about the best explanation anybody can give you right now for how such a thing would happen. And I guarantee you we won't in anybody's lifetime listening right now be in a position probably to predict a site-specific double tornado like the one we saw there. That's just going to be beyond the realm of predictability for a long time, I think.
Actually, that's a National Geographic photo that we've got up with an accompanying story about that in Nebraska. You know, I was listening at 10 o'clock on the news to know, it was coming. Direction, and Gary Kenalty took the first 15 or 20 minutes of the newscast just to talking about the tornado and so forth. Yeah. And one of the things he was talking about where to go, and in the if you don't have a basement, go to the middle of your house, get away from windows. The bathrooms usually are good, maybe in the bathtub.
But he
said, and I've heard this before, if you're in a mobile home,
get out
and go and lay in a ditch.
You're better off in a ditch. Yeah, because the mobile homes are bigger, and they're easy by violent winds to pick up.
Yeah.
And so if you're inside, you're going to get picked up.
You can get thrown around. You have to be careful in a ditch situation. I mean, all joking aside, is to make sure that you keep your head above water, because you can find yourself in, like last night's event for us, that was heavy rain for a period of time. It could have been longer, as it sometimes is. We may even see some more of that tonight. And you can get an inch or two of rain in 10 minutes, and that's no joke. And if you're in a low-lying area by choice, you got to make sure you're paying attention to that. Because it'll come in.
So it's one of the safety rules in flooding, right? Get away from low-lying
areas.
Yeah,
right, so right.
If you're on a higher ground, then there's lightning.
Yeah.
It's just,
you can really find yourself in bad spots by trying to avoid other ones.
Yeah.
Well, I remember, I've many times visited Arizona where they have these dry ditches and so forth. And they always say, don't go anywhere near those if a storm comes through.
Yeah, those flash flooding. I mean, all that water gets in the mountains or gets channeled into that canyon, and boy, the water can raise really fast.
That's how all those people died in the big Thompson flood. They were all in the canyon instead of up on the side.
Yeah.
Josh wondered, what's the difference between tornadic and straight-line winds? So tornadic winds versus straight-line winds.
In terms of what it does to your property, there's not much difference at all. The tornadic winds always have a rotary character to them, so they're rotating around some central axis. And you can usually see that in the damage path that's left behind. And then straight line winds are, it's perfect description. They are simply winds that are pretty much in a straight line without any rotary motion to them at all. They just come roaring out of one direction and at the same, sometimes equivalent speeds, 100, 150 mile per hour winds.
Yeah, and they come, where do they come from? Canada, typically? Or
I think they're predominantly a northwesterly wind here in the summertime. When you get straight-line winds here, it's almost always a northwesterly wind because they do come from an upper-level disturbance that's coming out of Canada very often. Yeah.
But both associated with thunderstorms, generally.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So one flattens the straight-line winds, and then the tornadic just rips things up. Mm.
This seems like an incredibly rainy month to me, but apparently we've had much wetter or rainier months.
So we made it into the top 10 with the precipitation we had last night. Mm. I don't know if we'll get much higher. I think we're number 9.
We have a chance to get more precip. I don't know if
tonight,
we'll
right,
put
yeah,
us
well,
any higher on the list, but we do have some chance for rain today.
Yeah. And interestingly, I thought anyway, the of the top 10, 7 of those days have occurred since 1990.
Yeah. That's
wow. And actually, 2012 was the minimum, the least precipitation month of all time.
Oh, and that was the hottest summer. We had those 39 days over 90. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, but so, I think the record is in 2000, if I remember right. Somebody was just sending that around this morning.
Yeah, I don't remember.
And how many inches?
We're at 8-point-something right now, and I think the record might be 10-point-something.
Yeah, I bet you it's June 1996 or 2000, like you said.
I think it's 2000.
96 must be way up on the list.
96 is up there, too.
Because that had the rainiest day ever in Madison, June 17th, 96. I think we had 4.7 or 4.17 inches of rain in one day, one 24-hour period.
I was going to guess it was going to be 2008, but because we had all that flooding, but that flooding was mostly from snowmelt and not.
Yeah, it was precipitated by other
water
in the ground.
It had precipitation, but we already had a lot of.
Leslie in Tomahawk has something for you guys. Hi, Leslie. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was listening to you gentlemen, I think it was late last fall, and you were talking about the then current hurricane season and that it was a very light one and that you used the term bleeding out, that the atmosphere didn't have a chance to bleed out, and that we could see a much stronger, more severe winter coming up.
Mm.
And, of course, living here in northern Wisconsin, we broke every record for cold and snow and ice and everything. So am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, I remember talking about that, and it's because it's a kind of a new theory that one of our colleagues has, and it really is worth investigating. And actually, it shares some elements of some science that people have done down at Florida State University. One of my good colleagues down there has done some really interesting work on how the hurricane season may tell you something. Hurricane season in 1990 might tell you something about the winter in 1990-91. And we were wondering if that was the case, if we just hadn't had enough transfer of energy from the tropical warmth that gets going in the summertime to actual tropical cyclones, and that may manifest itself in some large disturbances in the wintertime. That didn't happen the way I expected it to. I don't know about my colleague. He may have a different opinion. But we were persistently abnormally cold here, but the whole hemisphere, I'll say this, the whole hemisphere this last winter was the warmest one since at least 1948. So it's really... really weird. It was regionally bitterly cold, but hemispherically, that was absolutely the opposite case.
Okay. So that's interesting.
So yeah, is bleeding out an official term or just something in the conversation?
Yeah, it's a Greg Tripoli term right now, but I know what he means. He means that you build up this tropical warm bubble during the summertime.
And you don't have time to...
If you don't get it out kind of in drips and drabs in tropical cyclones, maybe there'll be a big cataclysmic event that'll spend all that energy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That's very interesting.
Mm. Yeah, thanks very much for calling. And Jerry in Sun Prairie, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, good morning. My theory is, I know early part of June, we went fifth longest period without a severe weather. I was just wondering, just a week before that, the Great Lakes had just thawed out. I was wondering if the Great Lakes had a lot to do with our severe weather that we've had. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, because these storms are, for one, they're mostly coming from the west and southwest of us. So I don't think the Great Lakes would have a particularly important role. in generating them.
And the fact that the lakes were so widely ice-covered this year was really remarkable testimony to the cold that we had this winter. But Steve just told me last week that I think Green Bay and the Lake Michigan side of the peninsula, the temperatures, the water temperatures are 10 degrees Celsius colder than normal for right now. And that's bad if you're trying to fuel severe storms. You want to have a really warm, moist atmosphere, and that's hard to generate over a surface of water that's way colder than normal for this time of year. So they may actually have a mitigating effect against the development of severe weather, maybe in the Upper Peninsula or places in southwest Ontario downstream of them. That would be interesting to know, but I bet you they've had little to no effect on our severe weather.
Yeah. Well, would there be some negative effects to having that cold, those cold lakes, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan?
It might be when the storm moves over the lake. Mm-hmm. But that contrast, I don't think, is going to help develop the storms earlier on.
Right,
they're forming
that's right.
way upwind.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here on the other, you know, we've got California. We had on the other end of the scale, it had
drought.
Nothing. And it seems like there's a possible connection between that and a cooler summer for the rest of us. I've heard, anyway. You heard that? What's going on.
It makes some sense to me that I think the broad conditions necessary to keep California dry are a big ridge over the west coast of the United States. And if it's ridgy over the west coast, that means it's troughy over the central part of the continent. And troughy means flow from the northwest over us. And that's always colder than flow from the southwest. So that's not inconsistent with kind of what we've seen all winter, and then the connection between a California drought and a cool Midwest summer is not ridiculous.
Yeah. Tornadoes, are we going to see a bunch more? What do you think?
It seems like we got off to a late start this year, but we're catching up pretty quick. I think we're up, if there were one to the in Iowa County is confirmed, which I guess they're going out and looking at that today, then I think that'll be 8 in the state.
Yeah, and it seems like since about the middle of June?
Yeah, 15th right. It just started the last couple of weeks.
Yeah,
2 weeks ago.
So it's been every 2 days or something. Yeah.
How do they determine? Just looking at the kind of damage?
So they go look at the type of damage, I mean, we're talking about straight line winds versus tornadic, and straight line winds, it kind of just blows things over.
Yeah.
And tornadic winds, I mean, it just looks like chaos when it goes through.
Yeah, I've seen the straight line winds. You certainly know.
You know that it was.
Yeah,
It is a straight line.
It really is. It's perfectly named.
Perfectly named. Well, listen, we're visiting today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, also a professor, as is John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. You can join in with your questions. We've got open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Post a photo on my Facebook page, a weather photo. Back after the news. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at weather today. It's the last, it's the last Monday of the month.
Man.
And that means,
summer's almost over.
John Martin, Steve Ackerman, our guests, our weather guys from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening in. You may have a weather or climate question, too. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to John in Madison next. John, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. I wanted to note that the level of Lake Mendota is currently 5 feet higher than its natural level, approximately, and due to the dam at Tenney Park. And the colleagues of the weather guys at the UW are doing a transposition study where they take a scenario where the Dalton Baraboo storm of 08 is transposed over Lake Mendota, and we're hearing preliminary reports that will show the foot of water would go over the dam at Tenney Park. I'm wondering if the weather guys care to comment on the status of that report and what the chances are of having a storm like that, or even worse, one like the Dubuque, which is about double the intensity and volume.
I am not aware of that study.
No, neither am I. It's very interesting.
It's really interesting because you're right. Now, over, so they must be just dumping the rain in the bucket, because what happened up at Devil's Lake was also special because there was no other outlet, right? It all had to just flow out one way, which really led to a lot of damage. But I guess you're saying the same thing. It's all going to flow out over the dam at Tenney Park.
Yeah, I think that's the only reasonable outlet. The scenario basically calls for transposing the circumstances of that storm, but also using all the models, the current models that are now available to plot what would happen. Of course, a lot of the isthmus would flood.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and they probably have hydrologists in there too, right, to see how much of the water gets into the table and doesn't just accumulate in the lake, and then the watershed is an issue and all that. It really sounds very interesting. One of the things about the Dalton Dells thing was that the earthen dam was a big issue. They always are. I mean, there's no way that you can really protect property with earthen dams in the long run. If you get a saturated soil, the thing just goes. And that was really bad news. But yeah, that's really interesting study. I imagine the amount of rain that fell there is certainly not out of the realm of the possible for here over town. We've had plenty of 4-inch rainfalls, and maybe that one was more like 6 locally, but they're in the same league. They're just extreme, and it could happen.
Yeah, we were actually in the Lake Dalton area and drove by the site and it looks pretty sturdy right now.
No, I bet it does. Yeah.
It's really sturdy. Yeah. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. No.
I was thinking of the flooding earlier in Lake in Devil's Lake, which occurred in the early 90s. They had that big flood rain. It just stayed over Devil's Lake, and then all the terrain there played an important role in funneling. So we wouldn't have the terrain effect, but we still have a lot. And the lake levels here are getting high.
I was trying to think of who would be somebody from who would be
limnology.
Limnology would have to be the area that's doing the study.
Yeah.
So the Department of Limnology, John, if you want to, you could probably shoot them an email.
Yeah.
And get who the person or the people are who are doing the study.
Yeah.
UW-Madison Department of Limnology. Thanks for calling, by the way. I want to give Craig a chance to join in too. Craig, hi. Thank you for calling.
That I share your passion for the weather, but I was recently caught in a lightning storm on the Manitowish River in a canoe, and this happened to me in the past. And I don't quite know where to go. Sometimes it's a swampy area; you can't get out of your boat. And I'm looking at the angle from the shore. Do I take an angle to the shore and paddle below 30 degrees to the shoreline, or do I try to get out of my boat and into a campsite, which is often has high trees around it? What's the safest place to go when you're stuck in a canoe or a kayak in a rainstorm?
Is it a metal boat?
No, I'm in
a
fiberglass boat.
Yeah,
actually.
So yeah, if it was a metal boat, then I would say get off the water and
primary thing to do.
I don't know. That's a good question. If you're in a fiberglass boat. And the river isn't broad like the Mississippi, so you'll be really out in the open. I mean, streaming along the bank might not be such a bad thing.
Yeah,
you know, getting close to
the
bank, but still just floating down.
In fact, avoiding big trees, and I don't mean just for the lightning threat itself, but being blown over. If you can get to the side of the river that's less vegetated, that's probably the right place to go, and just get down as low as you can get your profile in the boat.
Yeah.
If it hits the water around me, am I going to be to get zapped?
That's why I asked if you had a metal boat. Fiberglass boat, I don't think it won't be nearly as bad as what a metal boat would be.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So it'll be spreading out through the water.
Plus, if you're on like a wicker seat or something like that, then you're even insulated by the air.
It's probably
your
bottom and feet are just touching it, and that's the minimum contact. So
yeah, right.
Probably be all right.
All right.
Yeah, sometimes I crouch down by the reeds or, you know, like you do in mountains, you crunch around the boulders when you're above timberline.
Mm.
So you're not the high spot.
Yeah, and
but
I can.
The water, man, it's tough.
Yeah, it is. That's right.
It is. And I could see that, you know, if you're, again, in a big open area where all of a sudden all the forests open up and you're surrounded by a field or something.
Yep. So there you go, Craig. Thank you very much for calling and good luck. Don't let the storms keep you off the water.
Right, yeah.
That's for sure. And Renee on Facebook wonders if we're headed for a strong El Nino this summer.
I was just reading that this morning because there have been predictions of this El Nino developing. One is developing, and at some point they were looking at it being a stronger one, but now they're thinking that it is still going to develop, but it'll probably be on the moderate end, which is good for us in terms of our winter. If you like snow during the wintertime, we don't want a strong El Nino.
Okay, so it's the
El Nino. It's developing, but it won't be a real strong
El Nino is drier conditions for us?
It is less snowfall.
Yeah, so we it's a little bit warmer.
Yeah, it's a little bit warmer, so we don't get as much snow.
Susie in Scandinavia, hi, thanks for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for taking my call. Quick question about microclimates and rainfall in central Wisconsin. I'm in Scandinavia area, which is west central Wapaka County. And lots of glacial formations there, hills, drumlins, et cetera. Some of them elevation 100 feet above the valley floors. Hmm. And the last two summers, 2012-2013, obviously very hot, very dry. Our valley was uniquely dry in that our surrounding valleys, or particularly directly to the east of us toward New London, let's say, received copious rainfall. And most of the storms forming right over the hill behind my house while we didn't get a drop. And it was two summers in a row of the same sort of weather pattern. And I'm coming to the conclusion that it might have something to do with the fact that we're sort of a hill face on the east side of what we know as the Central Plains, or Golden Sands, where, you know, there's a lot of irrigation, but it's naturally very dry. Is it possible that is actually affecting weather in our little valley, you know, being a west face of a hill range?
Oh, I thought you said you were the east face of the hills.
Yeah, I may have misspoken. I'm actually on the west face of the hill.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The storms were formed to the east of us over the hill and over our hill to the east, and then copious rainfall, you know, just right over the hill had adequate rainfall.
Yeah, it's you know, some of our rainiest days in the summer here in Madison are days with at least some easterly component, which means the wind is coming from the east in some direction, northeast, southeast, or something like that. If that's true up in the central part of the state, which I imagine it probably is, then you might be afforded a little bit of a rain shadow on the west side of even a small hill if the conditions are you know, they're just subtly different on the western side of the hill than they are on the eastern side of the hill and on the plains, and that might be enough. It's possible.
So here's
certainly has seemed to be the case.
So I'm also, I mean, the classic sense of lee dryness on the lee side of a mountain is we usually think of big mountains.
Right? Yeah.
So the winds flow into it, it flows up the mountain, and then you get precipitation, and then it flows down and it dries. Mm. So these aren't all that big. So I wonder also on the west side of smaller mountains and hills, if you couldn't get enough vertical motion to get the convection started, but it actually doesn't get going until you get to the ridge and on the leeward side.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
possible
that you begin,
there, too. That's
so
right.
So you end up
yeah.
having more moisture on the
yeah,
downwind side than
yeah,
on the upwind
maybe
side.
Maybe so. Maybe yeah. so.
I don't know if anybody's ever looked at that.
That's interesting. There might be a minimally high hill that'll do that to
right,
you.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Just enough to kick it off, but
yeah.
not get the precip there.
So you could get dry from both reasons.
Right, yeah.
If the hill is the right size.
Very oh, interesting.
For you. Call the irrigation company right away.
Yeah.
Thanks, Susie.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it.
That's a good idea.
Oh, man. Chris and Sainer, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Hello. I have a question. I'm reading a book called Arctic Dreams by Barry Lopez, and it's an excellent history of the Arctic. It was written about 30 years ago, and I'm just wondering if the experts could talk a little bit about what kind of change somebody would see up there now from 30 years ago.
Now,
not climatic, but ice conditions, yeah. things like that.
So it's Arctic Dreams by Barry Lopez, did you say?
That's correct.
Okay.
I think if you went in August or early September, you'd notice a big difference between nowadays and 30 years ago because the extent of the sea ice is substantially reduced now compared to what it was in the mid-1970s. And that's a really serious concern, which may have implications for subsequent seasons of the year as the globe warms, and we're trying to figure that out. So that would be one thing you'd notice right away. And I suppose animal migration patterns and their hardiness would probably also be affected by that.
Yeah, and the permafrost is also in that summer, late or early fall, that's getting thinner, so it would be more mushy, I would think.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And because the ice is going away and the ground is not as frozen, also along the coastline there's a lot more erosions when storms hit as well. So I think you'd see a bunch of changes.
Happy story.
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's probably one of the most affected places on Earth right now by the way things have changed in the last 50 or 100 years.
Yeah. And thunder as well. I mean, it doesn't occur very much, but you're getting thunderstorms up there, which you've never had before.
That's right.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you for calling. Not the best of news there. Vivian in Milwaukee has a question for you. Hi, Viv.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am wondering if, because Lake Michigan was colder than normal this winter, if that is the reason we are having so much fog right along the lake. We always have some foggy days in the year, but we have had, like last week, most of the days were foggy, off and on during the day. Mornings, evenings, we had to cancel fireworks, etc. Is there any particular reason for that?
It's very much related to what you're saying with the wintertime. It was so cold. So as John was saying earlier, the Lake Michigan is really cold now in comparison to its average temperature this time of year. And so, yeah, there's fog all over Lake Michigan. We can see it in satellite imagery. So, I mean, it's just a lot there. And if you're in Milwaukee.
So the fog is caused by the what?
So it's like what happens to us. It's the reverse. You have warm, moist air come over the cold body of water.
Yeah.
And that cold body of water then cools the air up above through energy exchanges, and that causes the fog to form.
Yeah, kind of. Maybe we're going to say this. Kind of like when we get, maybe in late March, early April, if we still have snow on the ground, you can get fog on those kind of days that feel relatively warm, but they're foggy because the warm air is coming over the cold surface.
Yeah. And then, of course, the fog keeps the solar energy from penetrating into the water and warming it up.
So it feeds back on it, keeping it cold.
That actually happens sometimes in December or even January once in a while.
Well, that's a different case. That's what I was going to use in my case. But in that case, the water is warmer than the air above.
So
then you get a steam fog where the water evaporates into the cold, dry air up above, generating a different type of fog.
I grew up in a community where tobacco was raised, and that's when you strip the tobacco off the plants. Was in the
steam fog days,
December and January.
Anyway, when you get those dry days,
it's called case weather. They wanted wet days because they wanted
wet days. They wanted the
leaves to be moist.
Oh, right.
So they weren't brittle when you picked them off the stalks.
Yeah.
There you go. Wherever you go, there you are.
The weather has to do with everything.
Sure does.
Thanks, Vivian. Appreciate the call, Jackie and Drummond. It's your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Yes, I have two questions, and I'm sitting on the side of the freeway. You hear the noise. First of all, has this been a really windy spring and summer? Because I'm a cyclist and I always have a headwind. And then a week ago, I was on a week bike trip in southwestern Minnesota, and 120 of us got caught in a torrential rain and serious thunderstorm and lightning storm. And no one. And when we all survived, we were just wondering: has anybody ever been hit by lightning while riding their bike?
The wind, and then the what about
the wind? We get so biased, and myself included, with regard to wind and the way we think it is. So whenever I bike, I'm always biking into the wind. And then the other thing I've noticed is that at the end of last year, I got a nice wooden rowboat, and I was looking forward to doing a lot of rowboating this year, and I can't because it's always windy. Yeah. So our own personal observations of what we want to do seems to influence what the statistics are.
But then I'll add a question. Do you take a preferred route most of the time when you're riding with your friends? Because it's possible. We're talking about the cold Lake Michigan, and there'd be other cold lakes in the state. They don't have to be the size of Lake Michigan. If they're much colder than normal, they can generate a more substantial sea breeze, lake breeze, than they would otherwise at this time of year. And so that might be one of the factors that's leading to a little bit locally windier conditions. I don't know if that pertains to you, Jackie, or not.
Yeah.
But the lightning strike is what we were all curious about.
Hopefully you got off your bike, because I imagine that you got a lot of metal.
We all rode because, you know, it was such a torrential rain. We would have frozen had we, but we all survived. But the bottom line is you should get off your bike, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea to be.
Don't you think you'd have heard of somebody getting struck riding their bike? It's such one. It's sort of a human interest horror story that somebody would have publicized in the current era. I've never heard
golfing and fixing fences playing softball with metal bats. But, I've never heard about a biker.
Right.
Yeah, I hadn't either. So at least, for now we know it hasn't happened, and maybe we can be the first. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Well, no, let's not aim for that.
Let's not aim for that, nor let's not aim for a, this is a good way to deal with lightning.
Yeah,
get on the bike and start biking around.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'll tell all my friends the answer.
All right. Thanks, Jackie. Appreciate it. And Marcus in Green Bay. Hi.
Oh, I have a lightning question. I live in a second floor apartment and my deck faces to the south. So last night I was watching the storms off to the south and my NOAA weather radar showed that they were at least 50 miles away and the sky was really lit up. I always love watching the lightning, off in the distance, and something was going on with the cloud cover too, because a little bit to the east, they were just super bright, super bright. But anyway, and I couldn't hear any thunder at all because they were so far away. But my question is, I remember as a kid, growing up or whatever, we always used to say heat lightning. It was like supposed to be above the clouds or something. So is there such a thing as heat lightning, or above the clouds, or is it just lightning? And the other one is, did you guys see that video where that lightning struck by the lake and it, burnt all the roots and everything? That was pretty cool.
No, I did not.
I saw a video recently of a tree in New York State getting hit by lightning. It just exploded. It was one of these surveillance cameras. It was unbelievable. So it might have had some of the same effect as what you were talking about.
Yeah. I mean, when lightning hits trees, it boils the sap. That's what causes it to just explode.
But, oh, man. Well, what about heat lightning?
So heat lightning is just regular lightning, except you don't hear the thunder. And I think it got the name heat lightning because, if the storm's on the horizon, you're going to see all the lightning, but you're not going to hear the thunder, and you're probably sitting in a hot, humid conditions.
Yeah.
And so you end up giving it that classification. There is also different types of lightning that comes out the tops of storms, but they're not. That's not heat lightning. Heat lightning is just regular type of lightning that I think most people are familiar with. And these things go up, miles above the storm, and they got nice names like sprites and elves other things. It's part of the electrical interaction of the storm with the atmosphere up above. It's pretty weird, and I think we really started observing them when we were getting these spy planes. So the planes were flying up high, and then the pilots started observing because they're blue and they're red and they're different colors. So they're pretty easy to pick up if you're up above them.
Yeah. And Rose in Egg Harbor, hi.
Hi. Last evening we were watching the sunset and watching the horizon over the bay. There was this huge cloud bank. And we could see sky above this cloud bank. And within the cloud bank, there were flashes of light and lightning that lasted for like 30 minutes, but it was all contained inside that cloud bank. And we just had no idea what it was. And it sounds like it might be this heat lightning, but do you have more information on it?
Yeah, that's probably just in-cloud lightning, which is, I think, the most frequent kind,
isn't
it, right?
It's the most frequent kind, yeah.
And, boy, you saw a really great thing last night, because it's not common that you can see that, where the rest of the sky is kind of illuminated by the sun, but you can still sometimes see inside those clouds that are just, going crazy with an electrical storm. But it's just in-cloud lightning, the same kind that would illuminate your bedroom at night if the storm were right over you. Most of those lightning strikes will be in the cloud. But it can be so dramatic when it's far away, far enough away that you can't hear it, but you can see it, and you can see the sunset behind it. Boy, that's spectacular.
It was incredible. It was just incredible. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks for calling. And Rick, you have a quick question?
Yes, I had a couple, actually, if you have enough time. One of them is I saw the column in the Wisconsin State Journal today, in which you talked about lightning and if you're caught in a storm, how to take shelter. And one of the things that you mentioned was to go under a tree.
I think we said don't go under a tree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oop, that must be a misprint.
Maybe it was a misprint. They didn't put the contraction in there or something.
Oh, I have to look in my in my version of the paper. But you're saying do not go under
a tree. Do not go under a tree.
No.
Yeah.
Don't go under a tree. Rick, you're going to have to wait until next month to ask your other question because we're out of time. Thanks so much for that, but don't go under a tree in a lightning storm. Mm-mm. That's for sure. And John Martin and Steve Ackerman will be back with us from the University of Wisconsin Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. The last, we will be back the last Monday of
July.
Yep.
Tomorrow we'll talk about a fascinating new book about the Civil War, and then we'll take a look at some Midwestern towns. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.